The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. From teenvogue.com, O'Shea Sibley tributes pour in from Beyoncé, friends, and family. And this article was written by James Fectora. And there is a note. This article was originally published by them. Tributes to O'Shea Sibley, a black gay dancer fatally stabbed after voguing at a Brooklyn gas station, have poured in following initial reports of his death, painting a picture of a dedicated dancer who was beloved by his family and community. Sibley, who was 28 years old, was filling up a car with friends while dancing to Beyoncé's Renaissance late on Saturday night, according to the New York Times. They were approached by a group of men who told them to stop dancing and used anti-gay slurs. When the fight escalated, one man pulled a knife and stabbed Sibley. Although his friend, Otis Pena, pressed on the wound to attempt to stop the bleeding, Sibley was pronounced dead at Maimonides Medical Center. The New York Police Department is investigating the murder as a possible anti-gay hate crime and are searching for a 17-year-old who is believed to be responsible for the stabbing. Beyoncé herself paid a small tribute to Sibley, updating her website with the message, "Rest in power, O'Shea Sibley." Others who worked with Sibley similarly posted about their memories of the dancer and his love of ballroom culture. His father, Jake Kelly, wrote that Sibley not only was the glue to this family, he was a great dancer and performer for the majority of his life. His spirit lit up every room he stepped in. His smile was contagious, Kelly wrote in the description of a GoFundMe for his son's funeral costs. To know him was to live him. He did not deserve this. Everyone loved his spirit. Sibley studied at the Philadelphia Dance Company, or Philadanco, starting at the age of 14, thanks to a scholarship, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Sibley was at Philadanco until he was 22 or 23. Then he moved to New York to audition for Broadway shows and continue dance lessons. Philadanco founder Joan Myers Brown told the Inquirer that despite leaving for New York, Sibley always stayed in touch. "He called me every week to say, 'Hey, J.B.,' or 'Hey, Aunt Joan,' and he would tell me about his auditions," she told the publication. Content creator Kaylin Allen posted about his own encounter with Sibley 6 years ago in Philadelphia, where Allen was asked to narrate a piece that celebrated ballroom culture. He called Sibley a phenomenal dancer and performer who lit up the room with his passion for the arts and his culture. "Growing up in Kansas, ballroom was new to me, and O'Shea was nothing but gracious and kind in teaching and opening my eyes to a world I had yet to discover," Allen wrote. "I am heartbroken and furious at the injustice that transpired this weekend. It is our natural born right to vogue, dance, laugh, smile, feel joy, and simply exist. But no one on this planet has the right to take those things away from us just because they don't agree with who we are." And our next article from teenvogue.com. "I interrupted the White House press secretary because climate can't wait." And this article was written by Elise Joshi. As you can hear in the video, my first sentences were full of nerves. Standing up to the Biden administration directly, an administration I voted and campaigned for in 2020 and at an event to encourage youth turnout for 2024, felt like a massive cliff jump. Every natural instinct was telling me not to jump. Still, my words were backed by the science that insists that we cannot afford new oil, gas, and coal development if we are to meet our climate goals. They were backed by the current reality of billions of people impacted by extreme heat, drought, wildfires, storms, famine, and other fossil fuel intensified disasters. and they were bound by Biden's own words, spoken when he was a candidate, no more drilling on federal lands, period. Period, period, period. I could do this, I told myself. Hold the ground, relay the science, tell the truth about what's happening. And here's the truth. The oil and gas industry artificially jacks up our energy costs and pollutes our air, water, and bodies, all while making a profit of hundreds of billions of dollars. And yet, the Biden administration totaled 6,430 oil and gas permit approvals in its first 2 years, outpacing the Trump administration's 6,172 approvals over the same time frame. The Biden administration's 2023 record alone includes fast-tracking the Mountain Valley Pipeline in the debt ceiling bill, holding a 73-million-acre Italy-size offshore oil lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico, approving exports for the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas (LNG) project, and more. On August 10, 2020, when Joe Biden accepted the Democratic nomination for president, he said, "One of the most powerful voices we hear in the country today is from our young people. They're speaking to the inequality and injustice that has grown up in America. Economic injustice, racial injustice, environmental injustice." But 3 years later, many young people don't feel like the president is living up to his promise and still hearing their voices. From October 2022 to March 2023, after the approval of the Willow Project, support by those ages 18 to 29 for Biden's climate and environmental policy dropped 13%, down to 35% approval. With just over a year until the 2024 general election, President Biden's continuing support for fossil fuels is putting his support from young people, a key to Democratic victories in 2020 and 2022, at risk. Karine Jean-Pierre's response to my question was this: Biden has taken more action on climate change than any other president. But that wasn't what I was asking, nor is that enough. A quarter of emissions come from fossil fuel extraction on public lands. The Biden administration must stop comparing itself to the very low bar of past administrations and instead stop approvals of new coal, oil, and gas projects, set a managed decline of current fossil fuel production, halt the hundreds of billions of private dollars that fund fossil fuel projects aboard, and support workers transitioning out of the industry, and at the very, very least, declare a climate emergency. As Frederick Douglass proclaimed in The Significance of Emancipation in the West Indies, which Representative Justin Jones powerfully recited in his speech after my interruption, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. The climate strikes for a Green New Deal in 2019 helped lead to President Biden passing the IRA. We have and will only make progress if we push our leaders in the right direction. Young people are committed to doing exactly that. Since Thursday, July 27th, the video of me interrupting Karine Jean-Pierre has been viewed over 29 million times across social media. This comes less than 5 months after the Stop Willow campaign, which received over 1.1 billion views across three TikTok hashtags, 1.1 million letters sent to the White House, and 5 million petition signatures. These moments are no fluke and will inevitably keep happening until action is taken. So, what will it be, Joe? And our next article from teenvogue.com. What is a conservative? Understanding how the term works in American politics. This article was written by John Patrick Leary, and there is a note. This column is supported by the journalism nonprofit, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. The evergreen questions raised by the label conservative are, conserving what and from whom? Let's dispense with one popular answer to this question, asserted by many American conservatives and liberals alike, that proper conservatives are devoted to small government or engaged in protecting individual liberties from a big government. These are slogans of today's Republican Party, but there's no good argument to believe that the party behind the war on drugs, Richard Nixon, and later Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and every Republican since, the Patriot Act, George W. Bush, the first and second Iraq War, both Bushes, massive police funding, eliminating the right to abortion, don't say gay laws, and school book bans is, in any way that makes sense, devoted to limiting the power of the government. To make sense of the word conservative, we have to dig deeper than headlines and slogans. Like a lot of our political vocabulary, see also left and right, the political meaning of conservative came as a result of the French Revolution of 1789, when democratic radicals deposed the monarchy and the aristocracy. Soon after, in 1818, defenders of the French old regime founded a pro-monarchy journal, Le Conservateur, that first used conservative in the modern political sense. The magazine listed what it stood for in its first issue: religion, the king, liberty, and upstanding people. These were the things under threat from the new society formed after the revolution. Modern-day conservatives don't necessarily want to protect or conserve the same things as their 19th-century brethren. Not too many Americans will admit to being monarchists, but they do share a fundamental dilemma with their French forebears. Defining yourself in terms of an old order and its enemies makes it difficult to explain the sort of future you want to build. On one hand, conservatives defend tradition and duty. On the other, the definitions of these things shift with every generation. And what good is a tradition if it changes all the time? In 1790, the Irishman Edmund Burke authored Reflections on the Revolution in France, a polemic against the revolution that has become the foundational text of English-language conservatives. Burke didn't share the backward-looking attitude of Le Conservateur. Burke conceded that societies needed to transform over time, but he argued for a principle of social change that followed the examples of changes in nature or families, that is, slowly, over generations, and never all at once. Burke thought society should conserve what is worthy about past traditions, making judgments about what should and should not endure. I'd note this is the difference between a preservative, which preserves something, whether it be strawberries or something else, just the way it was, and a conservative, which conserves something about it. As Burke wrote, a state without the means of some change is without the means of its conservation. In other words, a society and its traditions cannot endure unless it can also change. This brings us back to the original question: what should change, and what should endure, and what is the principle by which one decides? Again, conservatives face the problem of defining themselves negatively against what they dislike. Liberal, by contrast, takes its name from a positive deal: liberty. Conservative, much like progressive, names only an attitude about political change over time. In 1960, the economist Friedrich Hayek, who many people would describe as politically conservative, wrote an essay titled Why I Am Not a Conservative, in which he argued that conservatives had not overcome this basic problem. By its very nature, Hayek wrote, conservatism cannot offer an alternative to the direction in which we are moving. It defined itself only against other political identities, he wrote, decrying what it is against without offering a positive direction of its own. Political scientist Corey Robin has recently argued that conservatism's most consistent traits are 1, a veneration of hierarchy and order, and 2, a fear of the lower orders. Though it is often claimed that the left stands for equality while the right stands for freedom, wrote Robin in his 2011 book, The Reactionary Mind, this notion misstates the actual disagreement between right and left. Historically, The conservative has favored liberty for the higher orders and constraint for the lower orders. And, he goes on, it has historically defined itself against the movements it opposes. To be fair, all political persuasions define themselves, in part, by what they are against. But it's especially true of conservatism, whose very name signals commitment to conserving something being lost or taken away. This helps explain the never-ending identity crisis that shapes so much of the culture of American conservatives, which is engaged in constant arguments about what it means to be a true conservative, and the confessional mini-genre of articles called Why I Am a Conservative. It also explains why so many on the right battle phantoms like wokeness, critical race theory, or the gay agenda, forever seeking new enemies to define themselves against. Seeking a more positive definition, the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, defines conservatism as the political philosophy that sovereignty resides in the person. Unfortunately for CPAC, plenty of political philosophers would say this is also a definition of liberalism. One of the most eloquent rejoinders to the veneration of tradition in conservative thought comes from the American revolutionary Thomas Paine, who criticized Burke's opposition to the French Revolution. What, Paine asked, are you actually for? Like American conservatives who proclaim their commitment to conservative values in a society riven by inequality, fear, and violence, Paine thought Burke was enchanted by more talking about virtue than he was by building a society that supported it. Burke pities the plumage, wrote Paine, but forgets the dying bird. Our next article, from TeenVogue.com, Donald Trump indicted in 2020 election inference case. And this article was written by Bess Levin. Donald Trump made history in April when he became the first U.S. president to be charged with a crime after leaving office when the Manhattan District Attorney's Office indicted him on charges related to hush money payments he made prior to the 2016 election. In June, he was indicted again by the Department of Justice for willingly retaining national defense information and conspiring to obstruct a federal investigation. Today, he was indicted for an astonishing record-breaking third time by the DOJ as a result of the federal investigation into his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. Trump was charged on four counts: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of and attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. Shortly before the indictment was handed down, Trump wrote on Truth Social, "I hear that deranged Jack Smith, in order to interfere with the presidential election of 2024, will be putting out yet another fake indictment of your favorite president, me, at 5 o'clock p.m. Last month, The Washington Post reported the bombshell news that the DOJ delayed investigating Trump's attempt to stay in power for more than a year, and even then, the FBI stopped short of identifying the former president as a focus of that investigation. According to the outlet, a wariness about appearing partisan, institutional caution, and clashes over how much evidence was sufficient to investigate the actions of Trump and those around him all contributed to the slow pace. Garland and his deputy instead were charting a cautious course aimed at restoring public trust in the department, even as some prosecutors below them chafed, feeling top officials were shying away from looking at evidence of potential crimes by Trump and those close to him. Before Garland was confirmed as Attorney General, the Post reported, senior DOJ officials and the top deputy to the director of the FBI killed a plan by prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office to directly investigate Trump associates for any links to the riot, deeming it premature, instead insisting on focusing first on rioters and going up the ladder. That strategy, the outlet noted, was embraced by Garland and FBI Director Christopher Wray, who remained committed to it even as evidence emerged of an organized, weeks-long effort by Trump and his advisors before January 6th to pressure state leaders, justice officials, and Vice President Mike Pence to block the certification of Biden's victory. Obviously, this undercuts Trump's repeated claims that he is the victim of a witch hunt and a weaponized Department of Justice. In November 2022, days after Trump announced that he was running for president for a third time, Garland appointed special counsel Jack Smith to oversee the investigation into the ex-president's attempts to steal a second term. Smith, who was also tasked with investigating Trump's handling of classified documents, began issuing subpoenas just 4 days after taking the job. In July, Smith sent Trump a letter officially informing him that he was a target of the government's criminal investigation. While it did not have prosecutorial power, the January 6th committee, which spent more than a year investigating Trump's attempt to overturn the election and the attack on the Capitol that followed, recommend the Justice Department charge the ex-president with federal offenses. In its final report, the panel called Trump the central cause of the insurrection, wrote that none of the events of January 6th would have happened without him, and warned, "Our country has come too far to allow a defeated president to turn himself into a successful tyrant by upending our democratic institutions, fomenting violence, and opening the door to those in our country whose hatred and bigotry threaten equality and justice for all Americans. We can never surrender to democracy's enemies." Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Selena Gomez celebrates 31st birthday by advocating for mental health. And this article was written by Ashley Carter. Selena Gomez celebrated her birthday by sending a sweet message of thanks to her foundation that supports mental health and encouraged people to donate if they could. The actor and Rare Beauty founder rang in 31 on July 22nd and decided to use the moment to thank people for helping to boost her nonprofit Rare Impact Fund. While posting a photo of herself blowing out candles on an S-shaped cake adorned with flowers, Gomez wrote in the caption how thankful she is for the work that Rare Impact Fund has accomplished. "One of the things I am most thankful for is the work we've been able to do with the Rare Impact Fund through At Rare Beauty," Gomez wrote in the caption. "Because of you, we've been able to raise awareness and increase access to mental health services for young people. This is my true passion in life." The Rare Impact Fund aims to reduce the stigma associated with mental health and provide young people with access to the resources they need, according to the fund's website. Gomez's popular beauty brand, Rare Beauty, also donates 1% of all sales to the fund. "People keep asking me what I want for my birthday, and I tell everyone the same thing. Please do not get me anything, but if you want to do something for my birthday, please donate to the Rare Impact Fund," Gomez continued. "If you have the means, consider donating to help us make a difference." Gomez has been open about her mental health in the past, including in an Apple TV Plus documentary about her life and career titled Selena Gomez, My Mind and Me, in which she discusses being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. The intimate film covers a 6-year period of Gomez's life that includes her canceling a tour because of mental health issues, a lupus diagnosis, and undergoing kidney transplant surgery. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Taylor Swift and Ice Spice text all the time. And this article was written by Sarah Delgado. Back in May, Taylor Swift shocked the whole internet when she announced that she was joining forces with Ice Spice for a remix of her Midnights song, Karma. But how exactly the unexpected collaboration came about was still a mystery. Until now. Recently, Ice Spice sat down with Apple Music One's Zane Lowe and took the chance to talk at length about working with Taylor Swift, dishing on everything from the genesis of the collaboration to how the Better Than Revenge singer actually waited outside the recording studio just to meet her. According to Ice Spice, it was Swift who first approached her to feature on the track. "I was home, and my manager called me and was like, 'Oh, Taylor wants you on a record.' And I'm like, 'Taylor?' the rapper recounted. "And he usually would just text me anything, right? So I'm like, 'Okay.' I was having a terrible day," the starlet continued. "I was crying all morning because I was just so mad at something. And then he called me with that news, and then I cried more because it was good news." "We get it, TBH." When the duo finally found time to link up in the studio, Swift was already there when Ice arrived and even waited outside to personally greet her. "We went to the studio, and she's so humble and so nice, I kid you not. I pulled up to the studio, and she was waiting outside for me," Ice shared. "I'm like, 'Why is Taylor Swift outside? Like, Taylor, what are you doing here?' 'So she's great. She's so funny.'" Of course, since then, Ice and Swift have reunited a few times. Just days after announcing their collab, the powerful duo actually performed their remix together during both of Swift's Eras tour stops at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. And, according to Ice, they have kept in touch since then. "We text all the time," she told Lowe. "She is effing hilarious. I'm not going to lie. She's the funniest person ever." Of course, the love is reciprocated. "I'm a massive fan of this brilliant artist, and after getting to know her, I can confirm she is the one to watch," Swift wrote on Instagram about Teen Vogue's June 2023 cover star earlier this summer. Swift isn't the only industry giant Ice has on speed dial. The rapper revealed that she and Drake also talk all the time, and she frequently turns to him and Nicki Minaj for advice. "I'll ask him, 'What should I do about this?' Or, 'How'd you go about this?' Or, 'Did you ever experience that?" she said about Drake. "I'm not going to give real examples, but he'll tell me, 'I did this and you should do that too, because you can.' And I'll be like, 'You're right, period. I'm going to do that.' It's like coach vibes." Similarly, Ice said that she's constantly absorbing advice from the queen of rap. "Minaj will tell me, 'Learn from my mistakes,' and I just really pay attention to what she's saying. Because if there's anyone I'm going to listen to, it's the queen." With Taylor Swift, Drake, and Nicki Minaj in her corner, Ice Spice seems to be in good hands. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.